Okay, we have been talking, obviously we're still in Romans, and we have, we're supposed to set up here real quick to move on to some examples, specifically an example of Abraham to demonstrate God's righteousness. But before we do that, I went to listen to that, the CD from the small group that we did at the Stegall's house. And there was a really important kind of building block that we haven't touched on yet. And it may not be, it may have been beneficial for anybody else in the class, but it was for me. And it was a very important concept for me to have down before I could move on to the righteousness examples of Abraham. So we're going to talk about that today, and that will probably fill up the majority of the class. If we have any time at all, we might move on, but I doubt it. But we spent just about the whole of our study, the last quarter and a half, discussing and demonstrating how law cannot save a lost soul, right? That we cannot be justified by keeping law. Do we all agree on that? Is there any discussion that needs to take place about that? Does everybody understand the concept of not being able to be justified by keeping law? In other words, you can't do enough stuff right to earn your way into heaven. There can't be a checklist of good things, a checklist of bad things, and the good outweigh the bad. Why is that? What's the principal reason that the good can't outweigh the bad? How many bad things does it take to keep you out? One thing, okay. So it doesn't make any difference how long your good list is. Yeah, I turn it back on. Thanks. All it takes is one transgression of the law and you are guilty of all of it, right? You're guilty of all of it. So, and that's a hypothetical example because nobody is going to be guilty of just doing one thing wrong. We're going to do way more than that wrong. So anyway, we spent the whole time talking about how law can't save you, how law cannot save a lost person or a lost soul. Discuss another topic. If Jesus Christ had never come to this world, would man be lost or would they be saved? Lost, right? He came to seek and save that which was already lost, Matthew 18. So we've established that law can't save us. We all understand that, or at least we're all on board with it, whether you understand it or not. How has law ever saved anyone, Old or New Testament? It's not a trick question. How righteous before God, right? No. Law has never saved anyone, Old or New Testament. Okay? Here's the reason behind that. If Moses or Abraham or Jacob or any of those guys could have kept law, couldn't I keep law? Were they not human beings just like me? So if they could have kept law and been justified by law, wouldn't it be possible for you and me to do it? Logically, yes, it would. But that isn't the case. They were never justified by keeping law. Now, I had a twisted view of this growing up. I had this view that people in the Old Testament were justified by law, and people in the New Testament were justified by faith through grace. By grace through faith. And that isn't the case. We're going to put a very important building block into that right now that Ken is going to pick up on next week. And so you probably want to spend the next week thinking about being justified by law in the Old Testament and being justified by faith and things like that. Because if you had that same twisted view that I did growing up, he's going to blow the roof off of this place next week. And it's going to be a very, very eye-opening class for you. So, if humans in the Old Testament could have been saved by keeping law, you and I would be able to do that. Clearly, it's not the case. So, we know what one has to do to be justified by law. You got to keep the whole law all the time, perfectly, which can't happen. Now, that's in Galatians chapter 3, verse 10. Somebody turn to Deuteronomy 27, verse 26 real quick. Deuteronomy 27, 26. Just whoever the first person gets there, read it. Okay. So in other words, Paul didn't make up the curse that Ken's been pounding home this entire quarter and a half. Paul pulled right out of Deuteronomy and says, cursed is he who doesn't keep all of the law. Paul didn't make it up. So that has been the case since the Old Testament. Deuteronomy was one of the books of the, starts with a P, Pentateuch, right? The first five books of the Bible are Jewish law, the Pentateuch. So Deuteronomy is one of them, and in Deuteronomy it's telling us, cursed is he who doesn't keep the words of the law. So this was not a new concept that Paul introduced in Galatians in the New Testament. This has been a concept since God put law into place. Now, the rules of engagement have been the same from the foundation of the world. Some, I need three verses real quick. I need Galatians 3, verses 10 through 13, somebody. Galatians 2, verse 21. And Galatians 3, verse 21. Galatians 3, 10 through 13. Galatians 2, 21. And Galatians 3, 21.
All who rely on observing the law are under a curse, for it is written, cursed is anyone who does not continue to do everything written in the book of the law. Clearly, no one is justified before God by the law, because the righteous will live by faith. The law is not based on faith. On the contrary, the man who does these things will live by them. Christ redeemed us from the curse of the law by becoming the curse for us, for it is written, cursed is everyone who is hung on a tree.
Okay, stop right there. This is the same context we just pulled out. Paul's writing a letter to the Galatians. Galatians 3:10, we have beat to death in this class. Cursed is everyone who doesn't keep all the law all the time. Which we just discovered, that is a quote from the book of Deuteronomy. Galatians 3, verse 11 says, clearly no one is justified before God by law. No one is justified before God by law. No one. And then he says, because, and he quotes, and you can jot this down. This is from Habakkuk. Is Habakkuk Old or New Testament? What does he say? Quote, the righteous will live by faith. Habakkuk Old Testament or New Testament? Old Testament, right? The righteous were living by faith in the Old Testament? Yeah. The righteous live by faith in the Old Testament. Verse 12, the law is not based on faith. On the contrary, the man who does these, here's another quote, the man who does these, this is from Leviticus 18, verse 5, if you want to jot it down, the man who does these things will live by them, talking about the law. Verse 13, Christ redeemed us from the curse of the law by becoming a curse for us, for it is written, another quote from Deuteronomy 21, 23, cursed is everyone who is hung on a tree. Now, for those of you who are in our prophecy class, I don't know, what, three quarters back now or something, three or four, we touched on that very briefly, but Paul is, in chapter 3, verses 10 through 13, all Paul is doing is pulling verses directly out of the Old Testament and putting them in a new context. Curses everyone who doesn't keep all the books of the law, all the words written in the book of the law. Curses everyone who hangs on a tree. The righteous shall live by faith. The man who does these things shall live by them. So this is not a new concept. It's new for some of us Christians that we thought the Old Testament people weren't justified the same way we're justified, but they were. And Ken's going to really get into that next week. Galatians 2:21. Who's got that?
I do not set aside the grace of God, for righteousness comes through the law, and Christ died in vain.
Okay. 2:21, Paul's saying, I don't set aside the grace of God. Because he's saying, why? If righteousness could have been gained through the law, why in the world did God murder his son? If man could have been justified by doing everything right, wouldn't that be a senseless murder? It would have been, right? Does God seem like the kind of person who would do a senseless murder? No. So it was absolutely necessary that Christ die on a cross. Absolutely necessary. Let me ask you this. Can someone keep law, moral or Mosaic, without having a faith in God? Hypothetically. I know, but can someone keep moral law? Can someone be a good, decent, upstanding person without any kind of faith in God? Yeah, sure they can. Right? We know people in our own lives, right, that have no faith in God whatsoever, or very little faith in God whatsoever, and are good people. They don't murder. They don't cheat on their wives or their husbands. They don't say ugly things to people. So he's saying that the law isn't based on faith. You can keep law without having any faith. But it can't save you. It can't save you. Galatians 3:21.
Is law therefore opposed to the cause of God? Absolutely not. For if a law had been given that could impart life, then righteousness would certainly have come by the law.
Which goes hand in hand with 2:21. In other words, if there, Paul is saying, trust me, had there been a way that people could be made righteous by law, God would have made that happen. And certainly people would have been saved by keeping law. But it couldn't happen. So if law can't save us, what purpose does it serve?
Make us aware of sin.
Make us aware of sin. Very good. What else? That's the most important thing that it does, by the way.
Shows us right and wrong.
Shows us right and wrong. All right. It can serve as, if nothing else, a guideline.
Shows that we need grace.
Makes us feel real bad.
Makes us feel bad, yeah. We're going to talk about that. It only makes Anthony Dozier feel real bad. I mean, not only can it not save me, like Anthony just said, it seems to beat me up pretty bad when it gets a hold of me, doesn't it? I mean, your conscience can really, really stress you out if you transgress it, can't it? Keep you up at night, make you lose your hair. Turn it gray if you're lucky. It's standing over us, standing over me every time I mess up, telling me, you sinned, and now what's going to happen to you? If I'm outside of Christ, you sinned, and therefore, you're going to die. Right? The wages of sin is death. You sinned, you're going to die. So what's the purpose of law? Well, make us conscious of sin, know right and wrong, lead us to grace, make us feel guilty. Let's turn, I got three more. Yeah, we'll do three more. Romans 3, 19 and 20. Somebody. Romans 5, verse 20. And Romans 7, verse 13. That's Romans 3, 19 and 20, Romans 5, verse 20, and Romans 7, verse 13. Whoever's got 3, 19, 20, just go for it. We've read it a bunch of times.
Obviously, the law applies to those to whom it was given, for its purpose is to keep people from having excuses and to bring the entire world into judgment before God. For no one can ever be made right in God's sight by doing what His law commands. For the more we know God's law, clearer it becomes that we aren't obeying it.
Okay, so that very last line is the crux of that passage. The more we get to know law, what does that tell us? The more we know how much we're breaking it, right? The more laws you read, the more you become familiar with what's right and wrong, the more you realize what? How much you're doing wrong, right? The NIV says, through the law, we become conscious of sin. Romans 5, verse 20. So that's the first thing that law does. It makes us conscious of sin. You can jot that down in your margins. It may or may not help you. Help me. Romans 5, verse 20. Okay, now does that, read that through, that didn't make any sense to me the first time I read it. The law was added so that trespass might increase? What does that mean?
To establish a rule, to let you know that you're doing wrong.
Yeah. Remember the fence we drew? We have to know where the fences are, right? Otherwise, how are you going to know if you ever transgressed the law if you didn't know where the fences are? Now, how do we know that? Where did God put it? He gives a conscience, right? And He wrote it on our hearts. Whether it's moral law or Mosaic law, it doesn't make any difference. We talked about before, was it right to commit murder before the Ten Commandments? No, it wasn't. It wasn't okay to murder before the Ten Commandments. We didn't need the Ten Commandments for Cain to realize it was a sin to murder. How do we know that? God said, where's your brother? What is Cain's response? I need my data to watch him. I don't know where he is. Now, did Cain do that? Did Cain say, murder? I don't know what murder is. What are you talking about, murder? Cain knew in his heart that what he had done was wrong and was going to hide it. First response. It's a human response. When did the Ten Commandments come? Way later. Exodus chapter 20. So, the more law is added to our lives, the more we understand the trespass that we go against it. The good news is, where sin increases, grace increases all the more. Right? Doesn't matter how bad you sin. Not saying that you keep doing that. We'll talk about that later. We don't continue in sin so the grace can abound. That's not the idea. But no matter how bad you perceive your sin to be, God can cover it with His grace. That's good news. Romans 7, verse 13.
Did that which is good then become death to me? By no means. But nor that sin might be recognized as sin, it produced death in me. Through what was good, so that through the commandment, sin might become utterly sinful.
Okay. Through the commandment, what? Sin might become utterly sinful. So through the law helps reveal sin for what it really is, which is turning your back on God, going directly against His nature. And the more you get to know the law and the more you get to know God's nature, the more you see sin for what it is. See, the devil can disguise it in such a way, particularly for society, that it's not utterly sinful, is it? In fact, it appears to be sometimes a good alternative. But, by the way, we call that rationalization. We have a fancy word for it, so we don't feel guilty about it. But that's what it is. It's packaging it in such a way that we don't feel guilty about it. Rationalization. But Paul's saying here in Romans that if you're intellectually honest with yourself, you will know sin for what it is, and it will become utterly sinful. And you won't be able to live with it, at least not peacefully. You'll feel guilty, it'll keep you up at night, all those kind of things. Okay, now I'm going to read Galatians chapter 3, verses 24 and 25. And this is the crux we do need to get on this part. I'm going to have to write something too. Galatians 3, 24 and 25. What we're trying to establish in this whole discussion is, what is the purpose of sin? If it can't save us, what good is it to us? Okay, if it cannot save us, why do we need law? We've talked about, you know, it makes us conscious of sin. That's a good thing that it does. It trespass increases all the more when we know it. So we know, we recognize what's wrong. It makes sin become utterly sinful. We don't mistake sin for a neat little package. We don't rationalize our way out of it. Galatians 3, 24 and 25. So the law was put in charge to lead us to Christ, that we might be justified by faith. And now that faith has come, we're no longer under the supervision of the law. That word, put in charge to lead, we're going Greek here. Pedagogos is the Greek word. Some translations, does anyone have a translation that says the tutor? Okay. Does anyone have an old 1611 King James, you know, the one that Paul used, that says schoolmaster? Does anybody have that one? Have you ever heard that phrase in this context? Schoolmaster? The English language, we don't really have anything that translates. I need Brian Lee here to help me write. The closest thing that we have, and actually I would even submit a drill instructor, is probably a lot closer definition of what this word really means. Pedagogos. I'm going to read a couple of definitions that I plagiarized. This is actually from the Jewish New Testament commentary. Here. Chapter 3, verses 24 and 25. At verse 24, the NIV says, put in charge to lead. It doesn't even try and call it a being, but that's what it is. The word is pedagogos. And what a pedagogue was, or a pedagogue, it literally means boy leader, not child leader. It's one who leads a boy or child. In ancient Greece, a pedagogos was a slave who conducted a boy or child to and from school. I mean, they were in charge of their everyday being, and it was usually for upper middle class or maybe even upper class people. They would hire like a nanny, but think of a really, really mean nanny, okay? Which is why I put drill instructor, because that makes more sense to me. Because schoolmaster and tutor, to me, a tutor is like a teacher's assistant. But what they were in charge of their welfare, their health, their food, their schooling, their discipline, every single aspect of that child's life from the time they were, whenever they were put in charge of them until they got to manhood or womanhood. This pedagogos was responsible for everything. Everything. Because usually the mother and father were upper class and they were off to far places and weddings or parties or whatever. But the pedagogos was responsible for everything. Everything that the child did. If they were sick, if they were healthy, if they learned anything, if they didn't learn anything, if they behaved badly, everything the pedagogos was in charge of. So Paul uses the word and says, the law is our pedagogos that leads us where? What's the verse say? To Christ. Right? Eventually, the pedagogos was responsible for that child until they got to maturity. And the pedagogos was off the hook. They were done. They could either stay with the family at that point, depending on what the family wanted to do, or they were actually freed slaves. Whatever they wanted to do, doesn't make any difference. Let's see. A tutor, a guardian, a guide of boys. Among the Greeks and the Romans, the name was applied to trustworthy slaves who were charged with the duty of supervising the life and morals of children belonging to the better class. The boys were not allowed so much as a step out of the house without them before arriving at the age of manhood. So literally, they couldn't even leave the front door without this person in tow. Does that sound familiar to us? Can you walk out of the house without your conscience? I wish, right? Maybe I don't. But you can't get anywhere without taking the law with you. Why? Whether you like it or not, God wrote it right here. Questions or comments? So we're about to get into something here. Okay, so that was from heartlightssearchgodsword.org. I didn't go to Wikipedia, although it is a reliable source. So anyway, everywhere the child turned, the pedagogos was there to correct them. So like a drill instructor, or like a tutor, I guess, kind of, schoolmaster, whatever you want to call it, he shows us what we're doing wrong, and then it disciplines us for it. So what was the discipline in this particular case in Galatians 2:24? What's law's discipline? I mean, what happens when you transgress law? Maybe I'll ask it that way. Death, right? Is that a pretty steep discipline? None of these words even begin to describe that kind of discipline. That's discipline. You mess up one time and you're dead. You transgress your conscience, we feel guilt, we feel grief. Sometimes our sin creates problems for other people, usually, actually, more so than it doesn't. All those things happen, but ultimately, the penalty for sin is death. And the law is the pedagogos. So we transgress law, pedagogos tells us, you're going to die. And we say what? I don't want to die. I don't want to die. And the law says, too bad. Because the law has no what? Mercy, flexibility, no nothing. It's just law. There's A, there's B. There's black, there's white. Either you transgress it or you didn't. You transgress it, you die. I don't want to die. Too bad. Now, most of us probably in the room haven't ever faced death ourselves, but we've probably either been close to somebody who's faced death, and you've seen someone go through, we watched my dad go through battling cancer and dying from that. You go through various phases of that. You go through, you get the diagnosis, and of course, your world just comes to an end, right? It's over. And then panic kind of sets in, right? So this is anybody who faces death, and their family too sometimes. You panic. You start looking everywhere. Oh, well, there's MD Anderson Cancer Center. They'll cure everything. Or there's Well, there's all these experimental treatments. You can go to Arkansas or to Oklahoma or to Germany, and we start running, right? We run scared because we're facing death, and we don't want to die, but that's what we're doing. And we panic, and we run, and then eventually the realization hits, right? There is no running from it. It's going to happen. And so then the law is telling us this whole time, you're going to die. And we look up, and the law tells you you're going to die. And you look down, and the law tells you you're going to die. And you look to the left, and the law tells you you're going to die. And you look behind you, and you're going to die. You look in front of you, and you're going to die. It doesn't make any difference what you do, you're going to die. And he's beating you, literally beating you up this hill, telling you you're going to die. And you're running, scared to death. Literally scared to death, because you're going to die because of your sin. That's the wages. That's the penalty. And so you're going uphill, and there's nothing you can do about it. He's beating you up there. So we get to the top of this hill that the law has been whipping us up, and you're defeated, and you're broken, and you're void of all hope. You have no hope left whatsoever. And you look up, and standing there in front of you, towering over your head, is a cross. And you fall down on your face and you say, God, have mercy on me. Literally, the sinner, is what the verse says. And the law comes up and taps you on the shoulder and says, I'm out of here. I did my job. He leaps. So what's the purpose of law? Lead you to Christ, right? Without the law, would I have never known that there was a better alternative than the cross? But not until you're completely void of all your hope will you really, really, really appreciate the cross and Christ's sacrifice. Any questions or comments about that? Any questions or comments? Okay. So it comes up, taps you on the shoulder and says, I'm out of here. You finally get it. You get it. Because we think the whole time we're going through this exercise that, well, I can do it myself, right? I have a 3-year-old daughter. Maybe you met her. Her name's Taylor. She's kind of loud, like her daddy. And we're at the phase, we've been at the phase a while, in fact, that her five favorite words are, I can do it myself. I don't need you to help me brush my teeth. I don't need you to help me eat my food. I don't need you to help me get the chocolate milk out of the fridge. I don't need you to help me clean it up after I spill it. I can do it myself. Can she do it herself? No, she can't do it herself. She can barely do it with me helping her. Much less do it herself. Do we ever do that? Most of us spend almost our entire lives saying, I can do it myself. It's the American way. You make your own way. You pull up bootstraps and you get it done. You don't rely on other people for help. Well, we get that philosophy ingrained in us and we carry it over to our faith. And we tell God, I'll do it myself. I'll help all these other people with their salvation because I got mine taken care of. And what is the reality? We don't get it. Because you can't do it yourself. You haven't been beat enough yet. You haven't had your nose bloodied bad enough by the law to learn how to do it yourself. But does God let us? You bet. You want to do it yourself? Taylor, go on, brush your teeth. Mom can clean up the mess when it's all done. And God tells us, go ahead. You can get it done yourself? Knock your lights out. I'll be here when you get done. And ultimately what happens? One of two things are going to happen. Either you're going to accept the fact that you cannot do it yourself, and you're going to come crawling to the foot of the cross and say, God, have mercy on me, the sinner. Or what else is going to happen? What's the alternative? You're going to die. That's right. You will spend your whole life trying to do it, and you will fool the majority of people, because the majority of people don't know you real well. And you can put on a good enough face for them to say, man, that old Eric, he's got it figured out now. Got a wife, and she seems happy. She puts on a better face than he does. Kids are happy. He's a good guy. He substitutes Bible class. He does all these great things. But inside, what's going on? Yeah, I know I'm not getting it done, right? And nobody knows better than me if I'm getting it done or not. My conscience keeps me up at night. All these things. My hair falls out. I attribute that to that, by the way. But you don't get it yet. You don't get it. And you don't appreciate salvation until you do. Until you get it. So that was the majority, really, of what I wanted to cover. Because until we understand the purpose of why God gave us law, because we've been beating it up pretty bad this entire time in this class of what law does, what it does for. Is law good or bad? What do we decide? It's good, right? Ken's mentioned before, you want to live in a world with no law? I don't think you do. If you do, go to a third world country if you want to live in a place where there's no law or where the law is money. That's the only law there is. We don't want to live in a place like that. And law does serve a purpose. It makes us aware of our sin, primarily. But it also leads us to Christ. We may fight kicking and screaming all the way there, swearing up and down we can get it done by ourselves. But eventually, something will happen inside you and it clicks. And you figure out, I can't do it all by myself. I can't. But it takes us a long, long, long time. More so in this culture than in others, by the way. It's not as difficult to make Christians in other parts of the world because they don't have anything. We've got everything here in the United States, particularly in this part of the United States. We've got everything. So what kind of alternative is God? The world views it as a restrictive alternative. Yeah.
Something just completely detrimental, whether it be job-wise or family-wise, to bring you to your knees. The really super rich, though, they don't need the Lord. I mean, they scoff at the Lord.
Yeah. But can society view them as good people?
No, yeah.
You can keep law, quote-unquote, we think, without having any kind of faith in God. In our society, you can be a good person. In fact, in upper society, it's actually looked down upon if you believe in God. You're better off keeping that on the weekends. You know. Yes, sir. Right.
And this is my opinion, but I think the dirty little secret is why we act the person you just described, that we are that person, is because we don't want to give up the world. That's why we act like that.
You bet.
That's why we are that person you just described. When we finally give it up, then that's when we
figure out the better alternative.
Some people also view Christianity as not only like restrictive, but also as a crutch.
Mm-hmm.
Because we can do it ourselves. And the only people that, you know, need Christianity or religion are people who have given up. You know what I'm saying? Like, people see that they can't do it themselves, and that's a bad thing to the world. So they need something else.
Yeah.
They're not strong.
No, you're exactly right. No, a lot of people do view Christianity as a crutch, just like you said. And I'm saying, I'm repeating this for the tape. I'm not repeating it because I want to sound profound on the tape and you don't get to. That's how it is. But the point he's making is absolutely correct in that, you know, particularly, you know, American society, if you can't get it done yourself, you're an outcast, you're lazy. You know, whatever it is, you're weak, and only weak people need help. Ergo, Christians need help, so they're viewed as weak people. Even though we have the power that can raise the dead. I'll never die. Physically, I will. But I'll never die. Ever. And no other religion on the face of the planet worships a risen Savior. Nobody. Everybody else is laying in a tomb somewhere, still, bones rotting away. And our Savior is not laying in a tomb anywhere.